free energy now.
Imagine a world in which each home has its own power generator that obtains its energy in such a way that no fuel has to be added. Imagine every vehicle being able to run without ever stopping for fuel. Imagine each appliance having its own power source that never has to be recharged. That is the world of the future. Join with us now as we track our progress towards such a world.
Welcome to Free Energy Now. I'm your host, Sterling Allen. You can join us online at freeenergynow.net to see our past shows, links to past archives, and see who's coming down in the next coming weeks, and to get some phone numbers if you want to chime in, ask any questions if you're listening live. Today is October 1st, 2007, and this could be considered maybe part two of an interview with Peter Lindemann. We spoke with him back on April 21st, 2007, 1 hour talking about Electric Motor Secrets, his DVD that he's released. It has all kinds of great information, and we talked in that interview about back EMF, eliminating back EMF, and getting some extraordinary performance out of motors just by some simple modifications, but not overly complex. And I'd like to continue in that vein with him, but also we're going to actually spend a good portion of the time today talking about gravity motors, which is his another love of his, something he's been studying along the way in his 30 years of free energy research. Peter, thanks for coming on the show.
It's an honor to be back, Sterling. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah, I went and I listened to our interview from the 21st of April this morning just to kind of refresh myself, and I was actually a little bit astonished that in that interview at how much information we covered and how well beefed up I was on the subject. I think if we were to have that same conversation now, I would come across as pretty much a dummy. I must have a good retention ability for short-term memory. And
well, I think we're all kind of that way. You know, it's there's so much information, coming at us that it's hard to keep track of it all.
Yeah, so, it is.
But I thought we covered that subject pretty well, and but we can go over it again a little bit this morning for your listening audience.
Yeah, what I would like to do in particular is we just barely posted a page at PezWiki about the Lindemann rotary attraction motor.
Mm-hmm.
That's a new page, and if I understand right, it implements what was in that DVD, the Electric Motor Secrets. And another thing that's different about back then is that I've actually been able to see this now in person. When you were at the Extraordinary Technology Conference back in July,
mm-hmm.
You set this up on your booth and were kind enough to give me a good demonstration. And so I've been able to touch it, feel it, see it, and be very impressed with what you've got there. It was a very convincing, very simple demonstration of these principles you've been talking about.
Thank you.
And you also started a discussion group. I don't know if it started since our interview or if there already was one at that time. If I remember right, there was actually one that existed at that time.
It was, if it did, it was only maybe a week old or something, because all of that was happening right around April. Things were getting started.
So there's now this discussion group of people who are attempting to replicate what you've accomplished there, and you've been kind enough to coax them along. We don't yet have a set of fine-tune instructions, as you mentioned on that page. You're focusing on principles, trying to teach people the principles of what's going on,
mm-hmm.
Rather than the particulars of, you know, here's how you make it A to Z. And that's good.
Well, what we saw, you know, because I was involved with you and John Bedini and the SG motor, projects and a lot of those websites and everything, and even when you give everybody, you know, an exact set of schematics and parts lists and everything else, they tend to make whatever they want to make anyway. So and you saw that over and over. So I thought it would be better to try a different approach this time, and rather than do that, let people get a free hand and teach them the principles so that they could create modifications for themselves. And this is going about as slowly as the other one did. So I'm not sure that we've found the best way of transferring information to the public yet. That's the forum has had about 16,000 views by various people, and I believe I'm in touch with five people who are trying to build one.
Mm-hmm.
Build something. So that shows you that the level of hands-on participation remains extremely low.
Yeah, well, that's a more complicated design. It requires buying an existing motor, modifying it. You have to know what you're doing pretty well electrically to tinker on that one.
That's true. It's not as simple as throwing some magnets on a dartboard or an old bicycle wheel. That's true. It is a little bit more complicated. But then the payoff is a little bit better, too. It's kind of a second step on, what we started with the Bedini SG project. You saw, and just about everybody who built one saw, that you could recover, upwards of 90% of the electricity that you put into it, to charge the back battery. And would you say that that's a fair assessment, about 90% recovery of the electricity?
Yeah, I would say that's fairly accurate. It could be lower in some cases, higher in others.
Right, but that's certainly an achievable goal.
Yeah, I would say that's an upper end, and that's a fair representation.
Yeah. So the real issue with that motor was that it didn't produce a lot of mechanical energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so this project is kind of the second step. It's a way of producing an effect that produces much higher amounts of mechanical energy, and still attempts to recover, upwards of 90% of the electricity input. So when you combine those two, you can see that there's significant advantages. And that's one of the reasons why John and I wanted everybody to learn that first step of the electrical recovery, because adding the mechanical, the high-end mechanical production, was going to be the next step. But
one of the things that kind of came to me as a surprise when we were at that Tesla Tech conference, I had my little Bedini Schoolgirl motor there on my booth showing it off, and it was spinning there, and with a magnet battery on the input, battery on the output, being charged from the secondary effect. And you came over and you're talking there, and you made the comment that, between the battery being charged on the output side and the mechanical energy being put into making the wheel rotate, that even my system that I had there was, quote, over unity, was harvesting energy from somewhere to end up with more energy at the end of the day than what was put in from the input battery.
Absolutely true. That was always true of the Bedini little motors. Especially the large wheels, like the kind you had, anything over 2 feet diameter where the magnets are running on a fairly soft arc by the coil. We've measured those types of motors at John's with a dynamometer, producing anywhere from 23 to 28% mechanical energy from the electrical input, and recovering 90% of the electricity on the backside as well. So when you combine those, you clearly see that it's over.
Yeah, that was a pleasant surprise. It's hard to prove that without some really nice equipment.
You need to get build a dynamometer and things like that. And because the systems, a system drawing 8 watts or 10 watts or something like that is pretty hard to measure the mechanical energy, because it's so low. It's under a hundredth of a horsepower, and it's easy to slow it down by looking at it cross-eyed almost. So the systems have to get a little bit bigger before it's easier to measure them. So, but it's there.
Yeah, and then after we were there talking at my booth, I walked over to what you had there, and you had your motor set up. You had a circuit, which was basically a variant of the Bedini circuit, except it was different enough that it's basically outside of his patent. It was something that you'd come up with to accomplish the same thing that he had accomplished with his circuit, which he has a patent on, which mm-hmm. we list on our Bedini SG project. And you were showing your motor with where you had gone in, and just tell us quickly what you had done to the internal workings of an off-the-shelf the motor.
Okay, I started with a simple fractional horsepower series-wound motor. And what a series-wound motor is, sometimes it's called a universal motor. It has brushes in it, but it'll run equally well on DC or AC, and which is why they call it a universal motor. And the motor in its when you buy it is based on Faraday's direct induction experiment, where you move a current carrying wire in front of a magnetic field and produces a lateral force. But it also generates a counter movement of electricity in the wire. And so all we did was we took the rotor, which is round and has slots in it that have windings in it, and we just sawed off two sides, so it ended up being kind of like a bar of iron with two rounded ends on it, so that it would mate to the stationary sections of the motor. And then we took all the windings out of it so that there was no electricity on the rotor at all. And so the rotor was just acting like a bar of iron. And then put a little wheel on the outside of the motor and embedded a couple of magnets in it at 180 degree intervals. And then just move that past a little what's called a magnetic reed switch. And we just used a very simple kind of magnetic switch that was used in the security industry years ago. It's not used so much now, but it would just indicate, you would just mount a magnet on your window and this thing near the frame, and so that it would tell the system when the window was closed. And but these things can actuate, turn on and turn off quickly enough that it was able to be used as a switch to turn a transistor on and off. And then all we did was just turn the field windings of the motor on and off. So we would turn them on just as the piece of iron was kind of beginning to approach an alignment that would magnetize the thing and draw it in so that it would want to try and align on the inside, and by that time we would turn it off so that it would slip out without any resistance. So it just started running on pulses of attraction, and then when the coil would turn off, we would collect that recaptured energy and light a light bulb or feed it back to the batteries. And I demonstrated a number of different modes, including just shorting it out or lighting a light bulb or feeding it back to batteries, and it changed the action of the motor considerably under those three conditions, and that was part of the demonstration.
There's a video of that we linked to on the Lindemann Rotary Attraction Motor page at PezWiki at YouTube, where that is explained, and at least a partial demonstration was given. I felt like the demonstration you gave me at the Tesla Tech conference is a little more complete than what is in that video.
That's true. I was showing a number of other variations so that people got a broader sense of the different functions. So yes, you're right. I was demonstrating live more than what is on that video.
Yeah.
But it still gives you the flavor of it.
And one of the things that was quite surprising is when you have energy being used on the back end rather than just throwing away, the motor actually ran smoother and faster.
On less energy, exactly.
It used less energy.
Right. And so an unloaded motor is generally, the load on an unloaded motor, meaning when you're not trying to drive anything other than the motor itself, typically speed is the best indicator of how much energy it's producing from a mechanical energy production point of view. So if it's going faster, it's obviously producing more energy mechanically. And you could see that it went the fastest when we were recovering energy from it, and it went the slowest when we were just throwing the energy away and shorting it out.
Which is basically what happens in a regular motor with back EMF.
Correct. In a regular motor with back EMF, you're shorting that type of energy out inside the motor. You're throwing it away, and therefore it draws more electricity and actually does less physical work for you. And that was part of the demonstration, which, these are among the principles I'm trying to teach people, that the motor wants to give you this energy back, and when you let it, when you set it up with a circuit that lets you give it back, then the motor's performance is significantly better.
Would it be okay for us to go briefly into some of the developments business-wise on your end? Apparently you've got some action going on that we discussed, and maybe that's inappropriate for this venue.
Well, all I'm willing to say is that since the DVD came out and since we spoke in April, I have gotten a small amount of private capital to continue the development of these motors. It's not a whole lot. It's not what I would call a major investment or anything, but it has allowed me to slowly and work on the motors and try and come up with a motor that takes advantage of all of these different things, so it produces high torque and creates high electrical recovery all on the same motor. And so I've been able to put in a few hours a day with this small stipend, and so in that sense I'm continuing to work on it. But I don't have any of those motors finished yet, so there's nothing really to report on, what they do or, anything like that. So, unfortunately, this interview is just a little bit too early for that. But maybe mm-hmm. next time we talk, I can give you some more details on that.
Another thing that we talked about in the Tesla Tech conference. Was, as you showed me the different components, the motor, the circuit, and you made reference to some of these things that are on the net about the work that you're doing, and you said basically Google the phrase Lindemann rotary attraction motor, and you'll find what you need basically. And you're not putting it all together yourself. Intentionally, you've got the different pieces. You've got piece A, component B, component C, and you tell people how to do those individual components. But you basically told me that if one were to pull all that information together and just connect the dots, that you would have a system that would, number one, self-run, because it would produce enough energy to keep itself running with energy left over for an end user consumption.
Well, let's kind of unpack that, because that I think is just a slightly misleading for the for your audience here. So the basic idea of this motor is that you can create a magnetic field by putting electricity through a coil of wire that's wrapped around an iron bar, and that's just called an electric magnet, and everybody knows that, and that's not mysterious. But what is not generally understood is that you can ask that magnetic field, once you've created it, to do two things for you. Not just one thing, but two things. Now, typically what they tell you is that there's a certain amount of energy in that field, and that's that's all you can, that's how much you've put in and that's how much you can get out. But actually that's not true, which is what's so interesting about this situation, because if you ask, while you're creating the magnetic field, if you ask that magnetic field to attract a piece of iron, do some physical work, okay, and then once it's done that, you can ask, you can turn the field off, and then the collapsing field will generate a pulse of electricity, which you can also recapture. So you can literally ask the field to do two things, and you only have to invest one thing to do that, and that is you put electricity in, you can attract a piece of iron while you're doing that, and then it will give you 90% of the electricity back. And so you can get this mechanical work produced at a discount. In other words, the amount. So for instance, if you can produce a mechanical energy production with your attraction cycle of, let's say, 80% mechanical energy production. So now let's say we put in 100 units of electricity and we can produce 80 units of mechanical energy. So we would have an 80% efficient electric motor energy production, okay? And many, many motors will operate at 80% mechanical energy production.
Mm-hmm.
But then, if we can then turn around and recover 80% of the electricity we just put in, and we've talked about Bedini systems being able to recover 90% and so on. So again, 80% is a modest, achievable number. And if we recover 80% of the electricity we put in, then essentially what we did was we ended up producing 80 units of mechanical energy for a net input of 20 units of electrical energy, because we put 100 in and got 80 back. So we only lost 20 units of electrical energy in that transaction, but we actually created 80 units of mechanical energy. And so even though this arrangement won't run itself, there's such a large excess of mechanical energy produced in relationship to the net use of electricity that if you take that mechanical energy and turn a generator to produce new electricity that wasn't in the system before, it's possible to add all this together and end up with more than you started with, which is a huge violation and according to the books can't happen, but in fact does happen.
Mm-hmm. In your mind, theoretically, where's the energy coming from?
Well, I'm kind of a heretic, okay? So my answer is this. It's coming from the exact same place that the energy comes from in all electric motors and generators, okay? And in other words, we haven't defined any function of, you know, putting electricity into coils, coils producing magnetic fields attracting iron, iron, you know, moving to produce mechanical energy, magnetic fields collapsing to produce electric, you know, impulses that are recollected on batteries and so on. All of these things are normal, natural things that have been happening in motors and generators since they were invented 150 years ago. So in that sense, I'm not saying that this is creating any effects or any energy that isn't produced in any other normal motor. So it suggests very strongly in my mind that there are problems with the idea of energy conservation because this arrangement clearly appears to produce energy that wasn't there before. But it's not doing anything different than normal motors. So there's a huge problem here for theorists, and I'm not a theorist. It leads me to believe that the first law of thermodynamics has problems. And that's heresy, of course.
Of course, you're familiar with some of the theories floating around. For example, T. Henry Murray, down in Orem, Utah, he's saying that these mechanisms, actually he's referring to an electrolysis system, that they're harnessing zero-point energy.
Mm-hmm.
And you have others who are comparing these electrolysis over-unity systems to the electromagnetic over-unity systems and saying that they're operating the same mechanism. And what
you mean, you're referring to Moray King?
Yeah, actually not T. Henry Murray,
right,
but Moray King. I'm sorry about that.
No,
yeah.
Problem.
Yeah. T. Henry Murray, of course, is departed and was a great pillar. Moray King has a similar name. But you were just saying that if maybe I could read or maybe amend or put my own spin on what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
You're saying that these systems, since they were invented, have been, quote, over unity, but it's been masked because of the inefficient design, that the back EMF working against the input energy has resulted in a net loss, whereas if with this new design that you're proposing and you're demonstrating with these refurbished motors, they actually, that back EMF is, rather than fighting against you, is being put to work in the form of output energy. And so that the over unity is now being manifest where it's been masked before.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it looks like. On extremely close examination, that's exactly what it looks like, Sterling. The back EMF produced in an ordinary motor basically is exactly what it says. EMF stands for electromotive force. And when you rotate a motor, it generates electricity within itself, which is generated in opposition to the electricity that you're running the motor on. So that, and this is why a standard electric motor draws less and less and less electricity the faster it goes, because the faster it goes, the more electricity it's generating against itself, and therefore it lets less and less energy through. But, and you can see this in the books, and I go through this in the Electric Motor Secrets DVD extensively. I spend probably half an hour out of the 2.5 hours going through this in detail, quoting the books, showing the diagrams, and so on, and then going back to the experiments and showing exactly what's happening. But the thing is that the reverse EMF or the back EMF generated in the motor is a voltage which has a minus sign in front of it, because it's being generated against what you're applying. And what they don't want you to see, or it's been overlooked, if we just forget about conspiracy theories, what's been overlooked is that the positive current moving through the motor minus or times the minus voltage that's being generated as the back EMF actually creates a minus watts value. In other words, let's say we're putting 100 watts into the motor and you're producing 90 watts of back EMF. Then only 10 watts is what's moving the motor forward, and 90 watts is actually disappearing into the motor with no production of heat, no production of anything. And so there's reason to believe that ordinary motors are violating the first law as well. And these things need to be looked at again instead of just saying, well, if you look at all of the forces as they occur in each step, something does not add up, and it's a huge discrepancy. Not small, it's very large, and that's, I point this out. It's a problem for the theorists, because if we're right, then they have not understood the correct. I mean, even if conservation does exist, then what happened? What we're being told, that 746 watts of electricity equals 550 foot-pounds per second of mechanical energy, which is typically, one horsepower equals one horsepower electrical equals one horsepower mechanical, then at least that conversion rate is the wrong rate, or it's not the only rate that's available. There may be another rate where it only takes about 200 watts of electricity to produce a mechanical horsepower.
Well, speaking of heresies, there's another heresy that we wanted to get into today, namely gravity motors, which is another area that scientists say that's impossible. You can't get energy out of static gravity.
Mm-hmm.
And you've been studying the work of Johannes Bessler and others, and you've been tinkering around with stuff yourself. You've built a number of prototypes.
You
know a lot of things that don't work.
I've built 30 models of different gravity engines, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them will self-rotate. But I have learned a tremendous amount about what doesn't work, which only leaves very little left. And I'm more than happy to share my insights with other researchers who are interested in this, because I am absolutely sure that it is possible, and it has been done. But Bessler absolutely built 4 working models of a wheel that produced mechanical energy simply from the moving weights. There's no doubt about that. And what is in doubt, or what is not known, is the exact design and the exact forces involved. But it definitely is, it has been done. And that is without question.
Has anyone been able to replicate that in recent times?
Not that I know of. I have put forward a number of designs that I have shared with John Collins, who wrote the book on Bessler. His book is called Perpetual Motion, An Ancient Mystery Solved. And also I have worked closely with Veliko Milkovic in Serbia, whose mechanical dual action mechanical oscillator is clearly showing mechanical gains from a what I call an unbalanced oscillation between centrifugal force and gravity, and that machine clearly works. So there is current work being done, in this field, which I believe is showing the way. I believe that Veliko's machine is the rudiments of a fully self-running machine,
uh-huh.
And that it demonstrates the truth about how to do this. And it also demonstrates a number of things. All of my experiments with pure gravity engines, and that is a machine that when the wheel turns, it moves weights, and weights are moved because of changes in the gravitational, what we'll call the center of gravity. Every one of those doesn't work, and what that tells me is that the machine that does work needs the application of at least one more force besides gravity. In other words, pure gravity engines don't seem to work. You need another force involved. You recently ran an article on the Messias machine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is a perfect example of a system which taps centrifugal force and gravity together. Okay, in other words, the rotating cone in the vertical axis, centrifugal force pushes water up the inclined plane of the vertical axis rotating cone. And so the weight of the water can be overcome by the application of centrifugal force acting on the column.
This week we're going to be doing a story on an inventor named Chris Kowalski here in the United States who has a prototype that's been stalled a little bit with a tornado that wiped out his house. Absolutely. But he's actually, he sent me an email today, said he's now in working with the university there to do some validation and testing of his device. Mm-hmm. And it looks quite promising. He sent me some pictures, and I plan to post a feature page on that this week.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, everybody knows, I mean, there are no arguments about the fact that if you spin something fast enough, it explodes. And the reason it does that is that the centrifugal force is building up.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a force that you don't have to pay for. In other words, when you spin a flywheel, the rotational energy is a conserved force. In other words, it'll sit there and spin. But the centrifugal force that's acting to try and tear the wheel apart, which, and these forces can be extremely large, is a force you don't have to pay for. And I believe that all of the systems, I believe that Bessler's wheel must have tapped into this somehow. I believe that, I know that Veliko's machine absolutely taps into centrifugal force from the swinging pendulum.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see that the Messiah's machine taps into centrifugal force to lift the water against gravity. So I believe that people who are working on purely gravity engines, gravity motors, things that are supposed to operate simply because of a shift in the center of gravity, should adjust their view of these things and start looking at an interaction of the components between gravity and centrifugal force.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think this is the way in.
The different gravity designs that I've seen also seem to actually be limited by the centripetal force, because as soon as you start spinning the thing more than, 5 to 10 RPM, you start getting the centripetal action that works against the mechanism that's supposedly going to make the thing turn.
Right, and that in other words, if you're in a situation where if you spin it too fast, all the weights just fly out to the end, and that's the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, exactly. And so you can see that it's a very large force, and that it will do things for you if you start looking at taking advantage of that somehow, because it's a very large force.
You saw the story we ran about 2 weeks ago, the Canadian who was allegedly built a fairly intricate gravity machine. Did you get a chance to look into that?
Yeah,
one at
the,
all?
The there's this guy who has, I've seen his videos on YouTube for quite a while. It's a fairly large arm that looks like it's got shifting weights on it and so on, and he's got this big braking mechanism on it, and as soon as he lets go of the brake, this thing just starts turning, and it gets going fast, and the only way you can stop it is to clamp down on the brakes. And if it's real, if it works, then it's an astonishing, development. Unfortunately, those videos don't show enough detail to have any idea what he's really doing.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, the jury's out. You can't make an evaluation from those images. But if he has what it looks like, it's astonishing.
Yeah, I tried to make contact with him. It seems like I ran into some dead ends in terms of finding out who he is and what his contact information is.
Yeah, if he has something like that, maybe he doesn't want to be found. it's an unusual situation, and there's so many things like that out there. The Stephen Marks, devices on the internet are another one where he's got these little coils of wire that you just plug light bulbs into, and they run the light bulbs, and
mm-hmm.
it all looks like he's got multiple working models, and yet nobody I know has the first clue about what that is, how it works, what's going on, or where this guy is.
Mm-hmm.
So there's certainly you know, a number of those things out there. You know, what we're trying to do, at least with the kind of information that I put out, I try and teach people, you know, the principles of what the machine is doing, just so that, you know, this kind of, it just doesn't turn into another story. You know, that everything's above board on the table. You know, like we did with the Bedini motors, the schematics are right there. If you build it exactly the way you publish the schematics, you can make one of these things that works, does exactly what it does.
Let's talk for a second about Bessler. And, you know, you said you've built 30 models. He's built hundreds, hadn't he?
He published 143 designs, which he says don't work.
Mm-hmm.
And many of the designs that have been floated around in the last year or two in these groups, tech stuff, its little weights on spring arms and things like this, all of those are designed straight out of Bessler's work, which he says don't work, and of course they don't work. I mean, when he says it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And Bessler did an exhaustive study on this field.
And tell us why, of the four models that you are certain worked, are you certain? What's the evidence that you're going from on that?
Well, pretty much the what I consider the authoritative review of this work is John Collins' book, Perpetual Motion. And his not only bringing together the eyewitness accounts, but also doing the historical kind of biographies of those witnesses to show that they were men of honor, men of science, men of knowledge, men of integrity, and that they had no axe to grind to say it worked or didn't work, and they said they saw it work. And so, in a court of law, that's as solid, evidence as anything could be. If you have a credible witness who says, I saw it happen, then you're pretty much left, in the absence of the physical evidence yourself, pretty much left believing it. And I do believe it.
Immerse ourselves in this history. Give us a quick rundown of why we don't know how he did it.
Well, he believed that it was a perpetual motion machine, and he called his inventions perpetual motion machines. Of course, that has been. And in 1712, that was an extremely controversial thing to say. There were people in the scientific community at the time who had come to the belief that perpetual motion was impossible. The assumption that perpetual motion was impossible was only enshrined in the first law of thermodynamics in the 1840s. So this is a full 130 years before that, before the appearance of the first law of thermodynamics, so it was still up in the air as to whether or not these things were possible. Most of the extremely smart scientists of his day, including Leibniz, Johann Bessler was in Germany, so a lot of the German scientists backed him. Most of the English scientists, like Newton, didn't back him. And so you can see that there was a lot of political maneuvering going on. But he wanted to start an engineering school. He was a very religious man. And he wanted to start an engineering school that was based on truth principles, and he wanted to be compensated for the production of the most astonishing machine that had been created to that date, which was a completely fuelless power plant, a machine that took nothing no energy input and produced mechanical energy. In 1712, this predates the creation of all modern engines. The first practical steam engine was James Watt's engine in 1776. Robert Stirling's hot air engine, typically called the Stirling engine today, was perfected in 1826. Otto's four-stroke engine that we use in our cars today was perfected in 1876, and Rudolf Diesel's engine was 1896. So Bessler's engine in 1712 predates all modern engines. It was a huge development, and it was the only one that ran without any fuel. So, I mean, if we could have had these things from that time, it would have changed. It would have changed the course of history tremendously.
Mm-hmm.
He was asking for 20,000 pounds sterling as a as an award. Basically, he wanted some wealthy person to buy the invention so that it could be given away or commercialized, because he didn't have the money to commercialize it. And this is the equivalent of maybe about $2 million today. But it's the exact award that was granted to John Harrison for developing the small, accurate pocket watch, which solved the longitude problem for long-term ocean navigation.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't without precedent that a 20,000 pound sterling award was an appropriate thing for something that was of this level of importance. For years, Peter the Great of Russia attempted to negotiate purchasing the wheel, which only caused problems with the king of Germany and other things like this, because obviously there was a lot of rivalry going on between all these kingdoms. And so there was tremendous political intrigue, and nobody wanted to fund it, but they also didn't want anybody else to fund it because of the possible military advantage it could bring to an enemy. So again, these are very similar issues to what is going on today. Obviously, the government has significant interest in not seeing a small portable fuelless power plant, developed in the public sector and published on the internet, because then every quote enemy of the of that government, whichever government we're talking about, would have access to this thing that could have, could change the military balance of power. So we're up against the same issues that Bessler was up against, even today.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we have some tools that he didn't have.
That's true, and I think that that the sophistication of military applications have gotten to the point where if we could come up with something that was similar to Bessler's wheel, something that had a very low power-to-weight ratio, something that was totally useful for a stationary power plant. In other words, if you needed to build a wheel that weighed 1,000 pounds and produced 1 or 2 horsepower, that would be no problem. Just stick it against the back wall of your garage and have it charge batteries 24 hours a day, and you could run your home on that. But you're not going to fly a plane on that, and you're not going to run bombs on that. And so today, the military applications of something like this are near zero.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the reasons why I really encourage people to look at this particular kind of development, because if we could come up with something that did produce energy in this way, that would have a very, very low power-to-weight ratio, that was good for stationary power plants but no good for anything else, then this might be the first type of thing that could come out and be useful, compete with solar and wind and things like this for off-grid power systems, and really have no military applications whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is the way to go. This is, I think, what will happen first.
Now, over in Europe, back in 2004, there was a company called Warrenlink with a device called the Environ Energy Warrenlink Wield, S-P-E-G-T. You're familiar with that one. What would be your take on that? Was that a fraudulent operation, or do you think they might have had something?
Right off the bat, Sterling, I don't recall that.
It looked like a wagon wheel with little donuts up and down the spokes.
Yeah, these things, I think that one, again, that type of arrangement doesn't work on gravity alone. So, again, there must have been some other, you know, if they were raising the weights using little solenoids or something else. You can get.
They had some kind of a bullet firing type of thing.
Oh, yeah, you're right. This is the gun engine kind of almost thing. Yeah, mm-hmm. See, that's the whole point. I mean, if you have to fire an endless number of small detonation charges to run this thing, then that's going to be pretty difficult. You may as well. It's a lot easier to burn a liquid fuel. So I think that was the it may not be fraudulent, but I don't think it's practical. Bessler's system didn't need any other fuels or periodic inputs of energy other than what was being generated on the wheel. At one point, they actually did a demonstration where he set the wheel up. I think it was one of the third demonstration set that he did in the set of years between 1712 and 1718. But they actually set the wheel up for a scientific review group. They ran stamping mills and water pumps and things for over 2 hours with it. Then they stopped the wheel, moved it from one set of bearings to another, proving that it wasn't getting any energy from the outside. Started it up, rehooked everything up, and then ran the stamping mill and the water pump again. It was one of the most nobles and scientists and ordinary people signed affidavits saying they saw it do this.
Hmm.
Utterly spectacular stuff.
Certainly fascinating. You mentioned earlier, and I can vouch for this, that as people are experimenting in this field, as they come across this interview, you are serious in your offer to provide consultation on this. I know people who have experimented with this who have gotten in touch with you and have found your input to be extremely valuable and sincere. So I appreciate that. Let's give your website out again.
Sure. It's www.free-energy.com. WS as in web site, WS. And there's links and all sorts of information on various kind of exotic and hopefully futuristic machines that have already been developed in the past, and hopefully we will be able to bring forward again for the future sometime.
Yeah, if you Google free energy, those two words, your website is still the first one that comes up.
So yeah, it's because I've been there since about 2001 or something like that. So it's Google tends to look at longevity. So I've been around a little while, and there is increasingly a lot of information on what I would call advanced alternative energy systems out there, and this, and your daily news service. I do two things to start the day. I fire up my computer, I read my email, and I check BBC for the world news, and then I check your site to see what's going on in the world of free energy. And I'm really grateful for your news service as well, Sterling.
Well, thank you. Peter, it's been a pleasure having you on, and keep up the great work, and until next time.
Okay, thank you.
And thank you.
You've been listening to Free Energy Now, brought to you by PES, Pure Energy Systems. You may access past archives and upcoming show info at freeenergynow.net and join us for our daily news at freeenergynews.com. We invite you to see our directory of energy technologies at peswiki.com. That's peswiki.com. PES, the Pure Energy Systems Information Network.